We are no longer on the brink of famine. We are in a state of famine. It's not a flood, it's not a earthquake. It's entirely man-made. By whom? That's there to say it. By whom? I'm coming from Washington and I dare to say, well, yes, Israel is provoking famine. Oh, how do you say that? What evidence do you have? Come on, what evidence do I have? Hundreds of trucks are waiting to enter. And it's absolutely imperative to make crossing points work effectively and open additional crossing point. And it's just a matter of political will.
David Griscom here, broadcasting to you all live from Austin, Texas, joined by my good friend and brother, Matt Leck. How you doing?
Good to be back with you, David.
Hey, I'm happy to be back. I was a little worried about what you were doing when you're unsupervised, but I caught up on all the episodes that are really great, and thank you so much for covering for me these past couple weeks.
Oh, no, happy to do it. Happy to do it. Yeah, it was a very fun time. I got to spend in Austin. I came back with a mohawk. I don't know if people have been able to peep that through the back there.
No, it looks sick.
I walked around. It was still the progressive bastion that I've always heard it was. I didn't see any sign of Elon Musk at all there. And yeah, it was
because you were going to places I suggested.
Right. Right. Okay. That might be it. Yeah.
We skipped the tour of the Tesla Giga Factory or whatever the hell he's calling. But it was really nice having you in town, man. And really appreciate you holding down the ship for me these past couple of weeks. We got a few things to get to today. We're going to talk about Haiti in depth very soon. We're going to talk a little bit about something that, I don't know, we haven't talked about, we don't hear talked about that much anymore, which is inequality and billionaires, which I think is something that, you know, for whatever reason, folks have sort of made an effort to sort of act like those kind of questions of inequality are no longer as prescient when somebody like Joe Biden is in office. But before we get there, Matt, I know you had something that you want to say about that cold open that we played up at the top.
Yeah, I just appreciated the frankness. I've lost the reference to who's speaking at the UN there, but a European diplomat. Israel is intentionally provoking genocide, and it needs to be stated so clearly. And, you know, this... We have to face the darkness. I think Senator Van Hollen from Maryland is now saying openly that Bibi Netanyahu's lying about UNRWA. The United States and the entire West has still suspended funding for UNRWA. So nonetheless, those lies have taken effect. One of the things I talked about with Robbie Martin with regards to conspiracies is the rush to judgment. And what are we afraid? Are we afraid that the people might think like, maybe intelligence services had something to do with JFK? We definitely don't want that, right? That'd be horrible. That'd be the horrible rush to judgment. The type of rush to judgment we do want is the American Senate, which is supposed to be the deliberative body, hears Bibi Netanyahu, known liar, say this aid organization is actually terrorist, and they immediately cut off the funding the exact same day that the International Court of Justice ruled that Israel is committing a plausible genocide. This is not process. This is not confused people. These people do not, this is not naivety. This is complicity. This is the every government that decided on that day to say, I don't want to hear that. I want to talk about what Bibi Netanyahu is saying about UNRWA is, along with Israel, provoking that genocide and intentionally creating that genocide. And all of the port making and all of the different hemming and hawing by Biden, how he's getting, it's all running the clock out. The clock is ticking. People are starving as we speak right now. And I also think, you know, we had this thing where the Canadian Parliament clapped for a Nazi. And all of those politicians, I imagine, are probably Zionists. A lot of them are supporting Israel in this moment right now. And we're talking about the Holodomor starvation in Ukraine. And that is a a crime that you put at Stalinist collectivization. And any sort of mass famine is man-made, and you cannot downplay responsibility of people in power for that. It was not, however, a intentional genocide. That is objectively a product of Nazi propaganda. Lots of people starved at that because of the forced collectivization. It wasn't intentional. And you can find no historians, not even the right-wing ones, that will argue that anymore. That's just objective. Some people would be surprised to hear that. That's not really... What I find galling, though, is that those folks had the... And it's not even that they don't bring up, say, the Bengal famine at the same time, where Churchill is as callous to mass starvation, right? Fine. Mm-hmm. But you're going to use the prospect of a famine for what was, now we know, like an imperial project. Of course, I think Ukraine has the right to defend itself against a Russian war. But are the objectives of the Western powers that are helping to support that, are they really sincere? Well, when they start to invoke something like a famine, and then literally a couple of years later, do one right in front of our fucking eyes, mm-hmm. you have to start to these questions of how sincere this is and what the motives are. You see, actually, they're pretty relevant. And I find it so disgusting every day we wake up. And it's nice that a senator is finally saying what everyone fucking knows. What everybody who pays attention to this even remotely knows, that, yeah, he's lying. And they call on anyone who wants to sustain Palestinian life terrorists. Yes, we are all at that page right now. We are all on the same page with that. Now what do we do about it? So, you know, I appreciate that we're speaking clearly about this, but the West needs to act. Because, again, I have plenty of time for the crimes of Israel in its less than century in existence. This is about the world structure that put it there and what it continues to do to the people that it's inflicted it with.
I think well said. And, you know, it's just been, you know, it never ceases to shock me how brazen, you know, the crimes that are being, you know, committed are, how out in the open they are, and the kind of tiptoeing around calling it what it is. Has been from people in positions of power and influence. So it's good when you see some folks, you know, using the right kind of terminology. But as you said, yes, it's very true that we need action, and we needed it a long time ago. Well, talking about, you know, another part of the world that has been just faced with the brutalities of imperialism and exploitation. We're going to be talking a little bit in depth about Haiti very soon. But I do have to just take a couple of minutes before we dive into that. You know, to note, it's even though I've been on break for the past couple of weeks, the Lone Star State has been hard at work with all sorts of dangerous and worrying things. We're not going to be able to go in depth into a lot of them. I'll be back this Thursday with a Griscom stream. So if there's any questions or more in-depth things that folks want to hear me talk about, I'd be more than happy to. You know, certainly there are things like the Supreme Court ruling, allowing at least, while the case is ongoing, for Texas to start enacting SB4, which is going to allow the police to arrest folks for transporting people in the state of Texas. Another major setback. We could talk about the Democratic Senate primary here in Texas. Where Colin Allred, a man in an empty suit, defeated progressive, sort of progressive, sometimes Pete Buttigieg guy, sometimes a strong progressive, Roland Gutierrez, in the Senate, in the Democratic primary for Senate, meaning that there's going to be another figure who's going to raise a lot of money in the state of Texas to very likely lose against Ted Cruz. Happy to talk about that more on Thursday with folks. Oh yeah, Jesus Christ, how could we forget the people on Reddit collectively organizing and getting worked up because pornography, at least from Pornhub, is now inaccessible for people in the state of Texas. Anyway,
look, I have some source. Look, whether or not I was in Austin recently and may have encountered a roadblock towards something not on Pornhub but a different website, incidentally, it's shocking to me that is, like, first of all, I'm like, is this not America? And I had that experience in Texas. Like, I am told to register with the state to masturbate to pornography? Are you okay? Land of the free. All right, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and it's a wild thing. So anyways, if people want to hear more about that, maybe join up on Thursday and hang out in the Griscom stream chat, because we got to get to, you know, the stories. There's too much to get to in this program today. But I do have to take a quick victory lap on one thing, because, and I know this is a little bit close to home, but these feature some figures who we love to hate. Jose Garza, DSA member, DSA endorsed district attorney here, won their primary election in Austin, despite millions of dollars going to their opponent, who was doing ran a really, really nasty, nasty campaign, and also was endorsed by none other than Elon Musk, who tweeted this. Sorry to bother everyone with this note as it applies to people in the greater Austin area, but please go to the polls and vote for a new district attorney. So a kind of coward's non-endorsement for Jose Garza's opponent. Elon Musk deleted that tweet because Jose Garza won overwhelmingly in the city of Austin, showing once again something that we have to remind ourselves that even though these little freaks like Elon Musk and someone we'll get to in a second, Barry Weiss, make a lot of noise, they're not very representative of the people who actually live here. In fact, Jose Garza defeated his primary opponent that was backed by Musk and a lot of the members of the right wing and certainly by the Republicans here in the Democratic primary, or because it's just, you know, this is it just for people who might get confused by that. It's like, this is just an area where a Democrat's going to win. So you have clandestine Republican groups oftentimes trying to push more conservative candidates in this race. Anyway, Garza just soundly defeated their primary opponent, 66% to 33%, despite Elon Musk putting a lot of attention on it. Certainly millions of dollars being brought into the race, or lots of money being brought into the race by right-wing groups.
Sorry. And remember how Myra Flores was the first time he voted for a Republican? He
said I wonder too. I mean, we have to go and see. I'm sure he's not registered to vote here either, just like he wasn't registered to vote in South Texas when he was saying that. And we also had Barry Weiss, she's doing her thing with the University of Austin, but reminding people that the University of Austin is not in Austin. It is in Dallas. she was tweeting out about Jose Garza. And with this bizarre story that she put out on her website, and tweet saying, crime in Austin is soared under a progressive DA. Tomorrow, Democrats will decide, is it time to put a moderate in charge? This is just factually wrong. Even on Twitter itself, they have a community note here. Shocking that Barry Weiss, a lover of truth and justice, would lie. The community note here is between 2020 and 2023, violent crime, property crime, and total crime have seen decreases per the Austin Police Department data. Very woke organization, as everyone in the city knows. And, you know, Austin regularly shows up to be one of the safest cities in the country, certainly in the South. And look, all I'll say is this, is very happy, despite all the shitty things that are happening in Austin, Texas, all the weird people who've been coming here, all the rich people who are trying to fuck up the city. It's nice to see the fact that Willie Nelson endorsed Jose Garza, and I'm very happy to live in an Austin, Texas, where a Willie Nelson endorsement is more important than Barry Weiss or Elon Musk. So thank you very much to everyone who got out the vote and made sure Jose Garza was in that position.
Yeah. I mean, it's good to remember for when these gremlins eventually ride, you know, maybe some reactionary sentiment to success, that it's not them that did it. because they don't have a lot of juice outside of that.
Yeah, no. I mean, it really is something else. Well, you know, before we get to this Haiti thing, there's just one last thing I wanted to do, which was, you know, look at some of these numbers here, which are pretty interesting. Mm. Now, with somebody like Elon Musk, you have to wonder, like, what the hell is this guy so mad about? And I think we have some clips we'll play in the post game. You get access to that patreon.com/leftreckoning, or we can maybe talk a little bit more in depth about our personal theories about this guy's psychology. But when it comes to somebody like Elon Musk, you have to wonder why he seems to be so upset, particularly about Joe Biden and the Democratic Party. As anyone who's been watching this program or anyone who has a head on their shoulders understands, the Democratic Party is not some radical left-wing pro-worker organization. It is a party that operates in the interests of the rich and powerful. Joe Biden's presidency has not been an exception to that rule, has actually been a really great embodiment of that. As we have right here, something that people would do a lot with during the Trump years, these inequality reports. This is from inequality.org, and we have new numbers out here. And this is from March 8th, 2024, a piece by Chuck Collins at inequality.org. Updates, billionaire wealth, United States job losses, and pandemic profiteers. And this is something, if people remember watching Left Reckoning all this year, we would use this a lot to look at what was going on during the pandemic and the lockdown, as we saw just tremendous amounts of wealth being generated by those at the very top, while the vast majority of people were suffering. But anyways, here's the update. Total U.S. billionaire wealth up 88% over 4 years. 4 years ago, the United States entered the COVID-19 pandemic. Forbes published its 34th annual billionaire survey. On that day, the United States had 614 billionaires who owned a combined wealth of $2.947 trillion. 4 years later, on March 18th, 2024, the country has 737 billionaires with a combined wealth of $5.529 trillion, an 87.6% increase of $2.58 trillion. Just astounding numbers. Absolutely astounding here to see the amount of wealth that these folks are enjoying. And let's just look at some of the names here. It shouldn't be surprising anybody here, but the past 4 years have been tremendously wonderful for folks like Elon Musk, Tesla CEO. His wealth was valued at just under $25 billion. By May 2022, his wealth had surged to $255 billion. Certain that's because he's been working really, really hard and hasn't slept in about 4 years. Certainly has been spending enough time with his kids. As of March 18th, 2024, Musk is at $188.5 billion, more than a sevenfold increase in 4 years. Jeff Bezos has seen his wealth increase from $113 billion to $192.8 billion. And that's even after paying out tens of billions into divorce settlement and donating tens of billions to charity. The Walt family is doing extremely well. Wealth is going up from $161.1 billion to $229.6 billion. In fact, the centibillionaire class is growing. Today, the entire top 10 of the billionaire class are people who have over $100 billion, bringing their collective wealth to a staggering $1.4 trillion. And the only billionaire in the top 15 to see their wealth decline in 4 years was Mackenzie Scott, Jeff Bezos' ex-wife.
yeah, okay.
That's sure. Because she's very famously, trying to give it away, which is, she's finding, not the easiest thing in the world to do, actually, just because of the unequal way that our economy is set up, where if you have money, you make a lot more. So, the point is here is to sort of look at one, the fact that, going back, just remembering, what we were talking about in 2017, 2018, 2019, Matt, and just reminding folks that, we're still in the same kind of conversation when it comes to inequality. In this country, we're still in the same kind of conversation when we're talking about the rate that people are paid who actually work versus the people who sit on their asses all day and get mad online and are tweeting out conspiracy videos on twitter.com. That's what the Joe Biden presidency has delivered, same as the Trump presidency, same as the Bush presidency, same as the Obama presidency. More and more wealth to those at the very top of society, while the rest of us continue to struggle. We're seeing the debate. We've been watching the debate play out for the past few months, Matt, as I'm sure and we've covered a little bit on this program, with the big brains in the Biden camp trying to present the American economy as a big success story. Everyone should be happy, and all the dissatisfaction that Americans are showing when it comes to the economy is just because they don't really understand the numbers or the macros. The debate within the Biden camp has been how to convince people something that they know in their hearts is not true. As Trump looks stronger and stronger going into this presidential election, as his numbers continue to stubbornly stay high, well, he shouldn't even call them high. They're competitive because Joe Biden is so fucking unpopular.
Right. Yeah. Trump is basically fucking rock solid. He's stayed exactly where he is, which is like not great, but better often than Biden is going to need him to be.
Yeah. You know, and I was just reading this the other day. Matt, don't worry. Joe Biden's efforts to sort of convince Americans that the economy is doing really well have been working. It now looks like 33% of Americans think the economy is in recovery, which is a big jump up from, you know, in the low 20s just a few months ago. I mean, for real, though, 67% of Americans think that the economy is in dire straits, is not in recovery. And we're looking at this as like some kind of successful metric of the kind of marketing and political communication strategy coming from the Biden camp. It's an absolute joke. And it's because you can't just bamboozle people in the way that the Democratic Party and the Biden administration are trying to do. Most people understand that life is more difficult for them, that they're not getting a fair shake, and the people at the very, very top are raking it in.
Yeah, you know, and look, Biden has, to his credit, talked about raising taxes to sort of save Social Security. And that is good. And if you look at polling for like Data for Progress, it's like that more than even the abortion issue drives people to his camp versus Trump when they're reminded of it. And I would like to believe that that is going to be a major theme over the next few months. And I don't want to say that there's no way it's not going to be. But I just think I worry because I think that this tax raise is really just letting the Trump tax cuts expire. And like that's fine. Right. That's one way to raise taxes on rich people is to lower them than the previous guy. But like, I don't know, I'm pretty cynical. I would be surprised if Biden, he's getting a clear signal to lean into a sort of class, which is what Obama did to win versus Romney in 2012, right? That's when Romney did the people don't pay taxes or whatever. That's how Obama won. Can Biden do that? You know, we'll see.
No, we'll see. And regardless if he wins or if he loses, the fact is that, as we were just saying, is that those at the very top, you know, continue to rake it in. Oxfam is saying that, you know, we're going to see a trillionaire in the next few years, right? Right. You know, so we could continue to have these kind of debates, right? And things could continue to get really heated over who's going to be the president of the United States or who's not. But the fact is those at the very, very top of the society continue to win while the vast majority of us continue to lose. And you know, it's Nowruz, it's the new year going into that, you know, with some energy. Yeah. We need to fucking do something new, and break out of this kind of game, because it is not working for everyday folks.
The cost of living is record high from anywhere from Manhattan to Port-au-Prince. And these people are giant pinatas full of money. Okay, we just have to get our shit together and re-seize all that wealth that is just being sucked up into. I mean, it's grotesque the type of and it is zero sum at a certain point. That these people, like, I mean, Jeff Bezos' fucking wife, ex-wife. I mean, good on her for getting rid of it, but I mean. Man, what a sick world.
Like it just shows something that, again, you know, with her, it's like, this is not somebody who's going out. Like, all of the kind of arguments that you're getting, you know, from these kind of they are just male influencers, but like, you know, the success bros, Patrick Bet David, who we might have a fun visit from in the postgame, patreon.com/leftreckoning to catch that. But you know, we did a video a while back on him on like AOC when he made this idiotic claim that AOC's was like sort of running on $1 million for everybody. And he made this point that if everyone got $1 million, that the same people would end up with all the money. 5-6 years later, which Matt and I, many people can watch it. You can watch it on our channel, the full analysis of that. But you know, Matt and I pointed out just like the fact is like, yeah, that's exactly the socialist critique of the system. And Mackenzie Scott, like, you know, not even throwing a shade to her. The fact is like, this is someone who's actively trying to give away her fortune. And you see how stubborn it is for her to do that, right? How difficult it is, yeah. And how she continues to accumulate more wealth, right? And it's, you know, it's not because she's some stock genius or she's creating tremendous like value with that money. It's just because the United States economy and the global economy is set up to reward people with money. That's true under the Biden administration, the Trump administration. That's true for Jeff Bezos or Musk. When you accumulate money, it's a really hard thing to get rid of because the entire financial system in this country and in the globe is set up for the wealth to continue to grow. And that's the point. It's not hard work. It's not innovation. It's the fact that we have a scam economy that benefits the few at the expense of the rest of us. And, you know, yeah, you could, you know, all of this individual stuff is just so nonsensical when you look at things like, actually, we should do a whole thing on Mackenzie Scott. I think that's a good thing. Maybe we'll do that in the near future. But anyways, folks, enough about that. We're going to go to our conversation on Haiti. Really, really was such a great thing to have our guest on. You can find links to their work below. Don't forget, after we'll be going to postgame, patreon.com/leftreckoning. We'll be taking some questions from y'all. We also have some fun clips and things like that. Really helps us grow, and you get a lot of extra good stuff for it. So come by for that. Enjoy the interview. We'll be back in just a little bit.
Welcome back, Left Reckoners. Joining me once again, back from honeymoon, is David Griscom. Hello, David.
Hey, friend. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Good to have you back. And rejoining us once again, Dr. Tamanisha J. John. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Politics at York University, studying Caribbean development, sovereignty, and politics, as well as Canadian foreign policy, economic imperialism, financial exclusion, and corporate power. Tamanisha, thank you so much for rejoining us on Left Reckoning.
Thank you so much for having me here again.
I want to say, I think Tamanisha is one of the great educators on, I mean, those issues. Check out our previous episode with her, not only on this show, but also on the Michael Brooks show. Today, the topic is Haiti. And, you know, Haiti, let's start with acting President Ariel Henry. How did he become acting president for folks who maybe haven't been tuned into the last couple of years of Haitian events?
Okay, I would say as a very quick backgrounder, prior to Ariel Henry being the president of Haiti, you had a character named Jovenel Moïse, who was assassinated in early July 2021. And after Moïse's assassination, it was the case that a man by the name of Claude Joseph previously, or for a short period of time, assumed power while the Western countries and a bunch of other countries were on this, oh my God, how can a sitting prime minister be assassinated tour? And while on that tour, the question then became by the international community, well, if this guy is unjustly assassinated, why is his pick, Ariel Henry, not automatically made the president? And then this questioning sort of brought to the fore in the global media the fact that Moïse was never elected in Haiti. He had no parliament, and he was effectively ruling by decree. And now, of course, Moïse's presidency in Haiti was made possible by the core group, which is why you had it that he was unpopular, was ruling by decree, and that there were no other governmental bodies or leaders governing alongside him. However, when Moïse suspended parliament prior to his assassination, it showed that within Haiti there was a lot of disagreement between the political and elite ruling classes. And we saw this come into play after his assassination when Joseph briefly assumed power prior to passing it on to Henry 2 weeks later. And so when Henry assumed power, it's because he was able to get support from the core group via a two-paragraph statement for him to become the president of Haiti. And the crux of this statement was essentially that Henry is recognized as the president, and U.S. and U.N. representatives shared the crux of that statement by recognizing Henry on Twitter, which is why Ariel Henry is regarded or known as the first president to be installed by a tweet. But really, he was installed by the core group, and their decision was only made public to us and to Haitians once those tweets obviously were put out. And so Henry was viewed in a very similar way to Moise by Haitians. That is, he was seen as someone who was unelected, illegitimate, unpopular, and would rely on empowering the police and different sort of security factions and mercenaries to maintain his position that he was not elected for. And like Moise, Henry received the backing of Western leaders. But unlike Moise, Henry was not assassinated, but made to resign by those same forces that put him in power, likely due again to these elite and political disagreements in Haiti that did not resolve themselves when he claimed power. And so if you remember a couple days ago, he had this very public resignation and people were crediting CARICOM and the core group for why he publicly resigned. But of course, you also have the fact that he wasn't able to return to Haiti, not just because of gangs as they try to, you know, make it seem like, but it's because the fact that Haitians have continued to protest Henry just as they did Moise, and they were protesting him a lot more forcefully given that he was out of the country because he was in Kenya to get support for this armed mission in Haiti. And so I think that that's very important to mention, because it's not the fact that a ragtag bunch of gang leaders or gang bangers stopped him from entering the country. He was unpopular.
Yeah, I mean, let's, before we get to the core group, I mean, that whole narrative frame, let's just address that for folks, because it is really like a throwback low resolution type of racism. I feel like we're getting from mainstream media where it's like, oh, it's gangs going on in Haiti, and that's why they can't do democracy down there. What should people, how should people understand the term gangs when sort of thrown out in this context?
So gangs, just like the core group, they all have a history and a function in Haiti. And so when we talk about gangs in Haiti, just as when we talk about any phenomenon in Haiti or any phenomenon in the Caribbean or anywhere, it is always my belief that you must lead with a clear class analysis. And if you don't have an analysis on capitalism, imperialism, and white supremacy, it's going to be very hard for you to understand what is happening in Haiti and other parts of the world in the Caribbean. And so it's not surprising that you also pick up on these sorts of racist narratives and tropes around gangs. I tend to focus on the Caribbean. And with that, I understand that I have to, you know all of these things about history, since that informs the present there. And also it has an impact on people living in the region there. And so you have to be able to talk about the history of colonialism, enslavement, indentureship, forced displacement, dispossession, forced isolation, foreign intervention, economic exploitation, and how all of those things have worked and continue to work to legitimize things like discrimination, exclusion, and underdevelopment in these places. And so as it regards Haiti, all of these things are true since Haiti is a Caribbean country. And so when I see the sort of gross and racist securitization of Haiti and the dehumanization of Haitians, I know it stems from Haitian history, and I know that it has both informed and impacted narratives on Haiti. And before, when I would talk about Haiti, I would always mention the Haitian Revolution. And now I don't as much, because I see that a lot of people tend to exceptionalize that or blame it for Haiti's current situation or use it to victimize Haiti. And then, you know, that's where the analysis starts and stops. But Haiti's revolution has informed its history and ongoing occupation and foreign intervention because of how Haiti becomes integrated into the global and Western dominated system of capitalism since that, you know, uncompleted or unfinished revolution. Haiti's security issues, we are told, stem from some unique and exceptional corruption of Haitian people, for instance. But it actually comes out of the history and current predilection of Haitians to reject forced integration into the Western capitalist system. Occupation from the early 1900s to today all have this in common. How do we challenge and undermine Haiti's revolutionary constitution that spoke about egalitarian ways of guaranteeing Haitians and free Black livelihood for people in Haiti? To today, how do we undermine Aristide's democratic policies that again want to assert more egalitarian ways of guaranteeing Haitians and free Black people livelihood in the country? And the only way to challenge how Haitians popularly or democratically want their country to run is to guarantee that the majority of Haitians are not heard or not listened to, which essentially necessitates a sort of political corruption that blatantly ignores the majority of Haitians. And the quickest way to do this while seeing some sort of return on your manipulation and necessitated corruption and investment is through security and security narratives. And so today's gangs in Haiti, a lot of them have their founding under the Duvalier regime, which was backed by the Western world, precisely because it integrated Haiti into Western capitalism, ignored the majority of Haitians in that sort of egalitarian way of living that they wanted, while also, you know, if you have mass protests, because Haiti is one of the most populous Caribbean countries in the region, you can always use those security forces, those gangs, and those mercenaries to squash that protest. And so the security narratives themselves at once paint governance in Haiti itself as corrupt, Haitians as backwards, and security is necessary for stability. But ultimately, what the security forces and the gangs in Haiti have in common from when they were first founded in the late 50s all the way into the present is that they have been suppressing egalitarian ways of living in Haiti to the detriment of Haitians. And what they've been pushing for is, you know, political corruption, again, incentivized by Western imperialism. So it's not corruption or imperialism or this or that. It's that corruption is something that is seen as necessary by imperialist interventions in the region to integrate Haiti into Western systems of global capitalism.
Yeah, it's this reminds me of, I think, the WikiLeaks cable that sticks with me the most of any, which is after Haiti had passed a minimum wage law, you get this cable, according to the embassy cable. This infuriated American corporations like Hanes and Levi Strauss that pay Haitian slave wages to sew their clothes. They said they would only fork over a 7 cent an hour increase, and they got the State Department involved. The U.S. ambassador put pressure on Haiti's president, who duly carved out a $3 a day minimum wage for textile companies. The U.S. minimum wage, which itself is very low, works out to $58 a day. And I'll just continue. Haiti has about, well, he just goes into the math of it, but this is how our diplomats are frankly discussing this. And so how, like, the idea that there's corruption, yeah, I would say it starts with the State Department. That's where the corruption problems lie. So, and you've mentioned this a few times, the core group. What's the core group for folks who see that term just, you know, mentioned in the first paragraph of news stories?
So speaking of the U.S. State Department, I don't know if you remember, but at the end of 2021, and if my own memory is correct, it either happened in September or December. And I want to say it was September, because in September, you had massive amounts of Haitian protests in September 2021, again, because they were trying to increase the wage per the Constitution. And what was changed was not the wage increase, but they were like, maybe we need to rethink that we didn't get rid of enough stuff in the Constitution about wages in Haiti. But at the end of 2021, Dan Foote, he resigned, and he was a special U.S. envoy to Haiti. And he cited the flawed policy of U.S. intervention in Haiti and core group intervention in Haiti as the reason as to why he was resigning, as well as the deportations of Haitians from the United States. And in his resignation, he pointed out that the core group supported Henry, which he also opposed. And he also said that the core group frequently ignores Haitian civil society. And he was disgusted by, and I quote, by the hubris that makes us, the United States, believe we should pick the winner again is impressive. And so when we talk about the core group is a group of foreign ambassadors from the United States, France, Canada, Spain, Brazil, and Germany, and a few representatives from the European Union, the United Nations, and the Organization of American States. And this external body and grouping of these people, they effectively manage Haiti. And this background is important here, and you'll see why. The core group arrived out of something called the Ottawa Initiative. And the Ottawa Initiative was a meeting that took place in early 2003, composed of the same aforementioned ambassadors from US, France, Canada, Spain, Brazil, and Germany to plan the 2004 coup d'etat in Haiti after Aristide became elected. And Aristide, when he was elected and was the president in 2003-2004, he actually instituted a lot of the neoliberal reforms that these countries wanted, but where they disagreed with him, again, was that he wanted to get rid of police and mercenary groups in Haiti. And this is very important because today we're being told that it is these mercenary groups or these gangs that are causing all of this corruption. But they planned that coup in 2003, and they successfully carried it out in 2004. No Haitians were present during the meeting of the Ottawa Initiative in Canada. And so obviously today there are no Haitian groups present in the core group. Technically, you have some people who will say that the UN Integrated Office in Haiti, or BINU, is the Haitian representation, but this is just an office with a UN representative to Haiti that has been credibly found multiple times to be enabling these sorts of mercenaries or gangs and corruption in Haiti. And so that a UN organ would be complicit in this is not surprising, because the core group itself, as we talk about it today, was formally established and recognized by the UN Security Council in 2004 after the successful coup in Haiti by these states belonging to what is now the core group. Recognized and officially established in 2004 after the successful coup, UN Security Council Resolution 1542 placed Haiti under UN trusteeship via the core group. So as such, the core group is responsible for, since 2004, managing Haiti. So when it is pointed out that Haitians have not had elections since the 2004 coup in Haiti, what is being talked about is this process where the core group has been the deciding factor for who and how Haitian institutions and politics run in Haiti. And I want to make sure that this point is clear, because when you mention the core group, some people believe that you're talking about political cabal or conspiracy theory, because of the ridiculousness of internal politics of a, you know, allegedly sovereign state being wholly determined externally. But not only that, in my mind, it points to the ridiculousness of the internal politics of a sovereign state being determined by people elsewhere. And not only that, but again, when we talk about corruption and corrupt leaders or the disaster situation in Haiti, this also forces us to acknowledge that for two decades, while under the trusteeship or the direct management of the core group, Haiti, and especially Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince, has been managed into violence and human misery. And so the question then becomes why? And of course, you have to then ask three other questions. First, why was there a coup meeting in 2003? Second, why was there a coup in early 2004? And third, why have the coup plotters and the coup carry outers' management of Haiti been disastrous for Haitians, but their trusteeship has been allowed to continue as sanctioned or supported by the UN? So when Haitians are holding those signs saying UN out of Haiti, core group out of Haiti, US, Canada, France, et cetera, out of Haiti, it's very clear to them who their overseers are, precisely because these things are sanctioned. These are not conspiracy.
So I just want to ask, just, you know, to sort of bring in like the most recent events into light. If you could talk a little bit, I appreciate the kind of highlighting how a lot of the narrative around this sort of misses the point, sort of treating this as solely like a security or corruption crisis might miss the point. But just to, you know, sort of paint the picture for some folks, I mean, for average everyday Haitians, what is the situation like on the ground right now?
So, again, Haiti is one of the most populous Caribbean countries, and a lot of the news and images that people are currently seeing, a lot of it is centered around or focused in Port-au-Prince. And while some people may take that to mean that, oh, all of this violence is only happening in Port-au-Prince and the rest of Haiti is fine, that's also a bad way to look at it. So, after the coup of 2004, and then you had the earthquake in 2010, and you recently had another earthquake in Haiti, what's effectively been happening in Haiti is that more and more Haitians have been forced to move to Port-au-Prince for employment. That's because whenever there is an environmental or a natural disaster and it messes up infrastructure in other parts of the country, or it renders other types of farming or those kinds of livelihoods untenable at certain points, a lot of people have to migrate to the capital to find work. And so when we talk about, oh, the Haitian wage is always being suppressed, what we're talking about is this situation in Haiti where a lot of people are being forced from rural areas to continuously migrate into the capital of Port-au-Prince, this being a perfect scenario for corporations from the West that are in Port-au-Prince, because now they can lower the wage and they have this massively unemployed force that they can always rely on or count on to keep wages low in Haiti. And so when we talk about sort of violence in Haiti, you have environmental disasters that are exacerbated by the killing of the Haitian agricultural industries due to U.S. and other Western food imports into Haiti. And then you also have the situation of free trade zones, manufacturing zones, and also countries like Canada just buying up huge swaths of land in Haiti to do mining, that sorts of creates these conditions where people are forced to go to Port-au-Prince for work. And not only are they forced to go to Port-au-Prince for work, but once they reach Port-au-Prince, they obviously, you know, protest because they want the agriculture industry to come back so that they can go back home in these sort of more rural parts of Haiti, or because the conditions in Port-au-Prince are so tight where there's a lot of people who are homeless, a lot of people who, you know, just can't make a living because they are part of the massively unemployed or underemployed class who start to protest. And so a lot of the violence is targeted on Port-au-Prince. A lot of this quote unquote gang violence, which is really just mercenary violence, is targeted in Port-au-Prince because you're creating a disaster situation where Port-au-Prince is experiencing overcrowding. A large sector of people are unemployed, underemployed, or paid very low wages. And the cost of living is a lot higher than people can afford, so people want to protest. Obviously, because you want to squash those protests, because this is the best environment for Western corporations to operate in, there's a lot of violence being committed against regular Haitians. And so Port-au-Prince at once becomes the area or the region in Haiti that has the most amounts of violence, because you've created a situation where people have to rely on Port-au-Prince for jobs, because you've rendered all other sectors of the Haitian economy defunct or captured under Western interest. And of course, people are not going to be happy about that. And I say this because I don't want there to be this narrative that, oh, I downplayed the fact that Haitians are being killed in this violence. No, it is always Haitians that have been killed in a lot of this violence. I see that for a couple weeks now, people have pointed out that a lot of this violence happening in Port-au-Prince for some reason are exclusively targeting the poor and workers, and none of it has targeted sort of elite sections of Haiti. And then today, all of a sudden, it's like, well, they attacked this elite section in Haiti and almost a dozen people died. But when you look at who died, it wasn't this elite faction in Haiti. It was still regular Haitian people. And so I think that all of this should be made clear to people, because at once gangs are targeting Haitians that are protesting for better wages, better life, you know, reinvestment in Haiti's agricultural sector. And two, a lot of the fighting that we see on the ground, it's not because the security or the mercenary forces are only aiming to suppress Haitians, but it's because of elite faction disagreements. And elite faction disagreements and fighting are in turn, you know, being played out in a sort of proxy amongst the population and these different gangs that arise. And so that is what is actually that is happening. And it's not that Haitians are just joining gangs to be violent. It's that, no, these gangs are fighting for their political or social elites in their country because there's about to be a transition or a change of power in Haiti. And each one of them are vying to be seen as the most legitimate actor to claim that power. And it's not to claim that power amongst the Haitians that they are brutalizing, but amongst other political elite factions in Haiti, and then these external arbiters of who gets to run Haiti.
Right. Oh, go ahead, David.
Please, you go, Matt.
I was just going to say, so now we have basically negotiations, it looks like, between Kenyan security forces and the core group. Any comment on that before we get to maybe what an actual sort of regional solution would look like that isn't under imperial dictate?
So something interesting is the sort of judicial roadblocks that they've been encountering in Haiti regarding, or in Kenya, regarding the deployment of Kenyan police into Haiti. I don't know if you all remember, but I think it's like 3 years ago now when Kenya was first being pushed to lead this multinational support mission, and that it would be the Kenyan police that would be deployed. A lot of people are pointing out that this would be a deadly disaster because, one, the Kenyan police are notorious. I think in 2021, when as soon as it was announced that Kenya would be deploying police forces into Haiti, it was also released like the very next day that Kenyan police were attacking people in Kenya who were protesting for more wages in Kenya. And so the Kenyan police force already has a bad rep, and then they would be going to Haiti where they don't speak the language. And so it's like, why would they be there? It should also be noted that none of the slated police officers from these different countries that they're trying to gather, I saw that they also went to, you know, talk to Chad, none of them speak Haitian Creole or even French to say that they're going to Haiti to restore stability. And so we already know that they're not going there to restore stability. It is my belief that the reason why the U.S. and the core group want a multinational security force to go into Haiti is because they realize at this point that in order for them to become involved in sort of this mercenary political elite back and forth, they need an even stronger block of force to say our force is aligning with this one to squash any sort of opposition. That's really what the multinational force is going to be for. It's not going to be to restore democratic procedures or structures in Haiti. If that were the case, then the core group would have set out something, you know, about them being dismantled or disbanded. So that's the first thing. The second thing is Kenya court's oppositions and saying that the deployment of Kenyan police to Haiti is illegal is sort of being circumvented by the fact that you have a lot of African leaders, especially in Kenya, sort of allied or allied to the U.S. and Western imperialism. So within the country itself, them sending these police forces are unpopular, not just in the courts, but also amongst regular Kenyans themselves. They're like, why would we go there? That's so far, has nothing to do with us. But the political leaders are trying to sell it as, hey, they're going to give us $200 million for us to simply deploy this force there. It should be noted that typically Canada would be the first foot soldiers into Caribbean countries to help aid U.S. invasions. However, a lot of the political talk in Canada is that it's going to be a death trap. It's going to be a quagmire. We don't want any parts of it. And so Canada has been very vocal in sort of talking to people in Kenya, talking to people in Belize to send their troops, precisely because they've made the estimation that it won't bode well for Canada. And so troops on the ground in the West is highly unpopular. And so they want this multinational mission. So you can see black faces being the at the forefront of this, you know, so they could talk about black on black crime narratives or more on corruption narratives because of the last time they went in, the disaster that was sparked from that. But I think that any sort of armed intervention in Haiti is going to end disastrously for the U.S. and the core group in general. I think it's going to end up being another situation like what we see today as it regards Israel or as it regards Ukraine. They're lending this massive amount of support for, you know, armed force in Haiti. This support is for people who don't understand terrain, who are going to be unable to distinguish between regular Haitians protesting against illegal takeover of their country and these gangs or mercenaries. And so what is essentially happening is you're just sending in death squads or squads that will perpetuate mass murder in Haiti.
Yeah. And so let's try to think of what actual solutions are as this sort of reality forms in front of us. You know, you mentioned Brazil as a member of that core group, and, you know, we've supported a lot that Lula has done. But I want to talk about, like, and when we talked, when we had you on last time, we ended a discussion on Barbados about the Caribbean states operating as a block. So I'm curious, like, what's the role of other countries, not America and Canada particularly, here, and both, like, as currently and, you know, I guess, aspirationally?
Okay, so I would point out that Lula has never had a great track record in Haiti. Like, I see today some people are like, oh my God, we're so disappointed, da 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 da. But again, Brazil was there at the Ottawa Initiative. Like, Brazil wants to professionalize its military. And part of that professionalization for Brazil has included sending troops into Haiti. I don't know if you all remember, but when MINUSTAH went into Haiti, it was headed by a Brazilian general. And I think that he later committed suicide because he said when he went there, the mission was unclear. They just seemed to be killing children. So that was a very, it impacted Brazil very negatively. And so that's also why even in this conversation today, Brazil doesn't want to send troops on the ground in Haiti. It supports the West going into Haiti, but they've been very clear, no Brazilian soldiers, because it's not just that a top general committed suicide and left that as his last message, but a lot of the Brazilian soldiers came back and were like, never again, not for us. And so we'll put that out there. And then we have this body now called CARICOM. And again, the core group has effectively been pointed out to people as disastrous for Haiti. And so the core group did something unique, but not unique this time, in that they solicited help from CARICOM to be granted some regional legitimacy for their armed intervention in Haiti. Just for a little bit of background, some people may not know this, but when West Indian Federation failed, CARICOM was born from the Caribbean Free Trade Agreement, or CARIFTA. And when CARICOM was born, it was to allow U.S. and other capitalists penetration into the region and not just the British. But nonetheless, given the history of CARIFTA, a lot of people associate CARICOM with regional economic integration of member states, even though it acts as a primary vehicle for economic integration of member states into Western capitalism. And so Haiti is also a part of CARICOM, for instance. But not only that, less discussed but extremely important when we talk about CARICOM is that their second mandate outside of sort of economic integration is to converge or have a solidified foreign policy. So how do we make all 17 of these Caribbean states agree on a foreign policy for the region? And that typically had a less analyzed role because a lot of people focused on sort of how Western capital was penetrating CARICOM for them to pursue different initiatives throughout the Caribbean. But I would say in the post 9/11 era, and you started to see it a bit after the war on drugs, you sort of had this foreign policy convergence of states in the region that allowed partnerships or alliances with the US, Canada, or France input into Caribbean foreign policy. And again, since they want their foreign policy to be almost unified, it means that now instead of having, you know, oh, only six states in CARICOM agree and the other 10 or 11 don't, so we can't do it, now it's like, you all must agree on this, and we're going to have 10 meetings to make sure we're all going to say yes. And if you disagree with it, you have to go into another body to disagree with it. But CARICOM as an entity is going to say this is our foreign policy. And I think that discussing that is extremely important because taken together, you have CARICOM's foreign policy mandate where they all want to agree on a foreign policy, and they also have this they receive a lot of funding and they do a lot of collaborations with Western corporations who play a part in determining what that foreign policy looks like. And so because of this, you more or less start to see why there would be such a convergence of Western imperial ambitions in this quote unquote community on Haiti. Not only that, but this is by design, given its external funding situation. Many people tend to blame the lack of regional integration on states' conception of their own sovereignty, but I don't think that Caribbean people are simply more prideful than Europeans to be able to craft something like the EU. And as we recently saw with Guyana-Venezuela tensions, these states are very clear regarding how they view violations of state sovereignties. A large issue has always been, how are they favoring Western capitalists? And then in regards to foreign policy, how are they favoring Western capitalist foreign policy? it was easy for them to say, we want a sovereign Guyana and we view Venezuela's overreach, when Western foreign policy believes that Venezuela is this aggressor that must be countered in the region. And when you have a similar situation happening in Haiti, where Haitians are saying, we want you guys out of Haiti and we don't want our sovereignty to be violated, it's very easy to see why they will say, well, no, actually, you do need to be under tutelage and we're going to help devise this presidential council along with the U.S. But since we're here, it's not strictly a Western thing to help you because you have an untenable security situation. I think that that's very important to point out because some people thought CARICOM was being hypocritical, but it's not that CARICOM is being hypocritical. CARICOM is still following sort of Western mandates on foreign policy, but doing it in this very weird way to legitimize intervention in Haiti. That being said, I think the last time I was on you guys' program, I pointed out how people view Mia Motley as this darling of the left, even though in Barbados, through CARICOM, when she was the chair of CARICOM at that time, and right now the chair of CARICOM is Guyana, she was selling out huge swaths of Barbados land to these real estate investors and made the cost of living in Barbados very high. I remember telling you all that, and again, today you had a lot of people saying, oh my God, I can't believe Mia Motley agreed to come up with this solution for this presidential council, da 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 da. But again, it's in line with Mia Motley's politics, right? She is also beholden to these same sort of Western funding. She has these Western corporate interests that she has for her country. And a lot of these countries want funding. For instance, even though we talk about gangs in Haiti, this year there's been more murders, crimes, and gang violence in Trinidad and Tobago and in Jamaica than in Haiti. But you don't see people saying we need armed intervention in Trinidad or in Jamaica. And that's because those are two countries that have successfully integrated themselves and pacified a lot of their citizenry into being integrated in a type of Western, you know, capitalism that the West likes. Again, that is not true for Haiti, where you have a public who has, again, been steadfast and resolute in saying, we want democracy and we want you guys out of our country. And so you just have to keep those things in mind. I think ambition-wise, what are states' ambitions? I think a lot of states in the Caribbean, again, thinking about history, thinking about colonial narratives, it is not just that the U.S. is trying to preemptively say we don't want Haitians migrating into the U.S., even though we're causing this crisis in Haiti. But you have a lot of Caribbean countries who are doing that as well. Last week, Jamaica and the Bahamas, they said any Haitians that they intercept trying to come into their countries are going to automatically be labeled as fugitives and marked for deportation. And they said that it's because they won't be able to distinguish between regular Haitians and Haitians who are a part of gangs. How are you going to be unable to do that? I don't know. But this is in line, you know, in the CARICOM community, you have people who have free movement across countries, but that has never been true for Haiti and Haitians. And so a lot of it is also incentivized by, if we make Haiti stable, we won't have Haitian migrants coming to our countries as well. And it's very racist, same sorts of racist language and tropes that these states use as well.
Yeah, horrible that that is such a widespread phenomenon, and that we're really setting the, I guess, the tone on that from the top here, both Biden and Trump, frankly. Anything else that we should know, Tom and Nisha, before we let you go on this?
I would just say that, again, today's violence in Port-au-Prince is a direct result or outcome of Western countries maintaining an urban proletarian class in Haiti, ignoring other sectors of the Haitian economy precisely to continue to feed that class so that Haiti is competitive, or in other words, a low-wage population in the Americas who are manufacturing all of these products and also engaged in mining. I also want to stress the fact that it's not just manufacturing, but it's also a lot of mining that takes place in Haiti. And any sort of armed intervention in Haiti will not be to stop corruption or will not be to bring democracy in Haiti, but it's to aid an already unstable and illegitimate governance structure in Haiti that are determined externally already, because patients continuously refuse and reject integration into the Western capitalist system.
Tominisha J. John, you can follow her at Tominisha John on Twitter and Tominisha John on Instagram. Thank you so much, Professor, for educating us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, she's great. If you are at York University, take Tominisha's classes.
Absolutely. Now, and you know.
Oh, I think we lost your microphone. Unless I'm bugging, David. Check 1, 2.
I mean, I should be here. You not hear me?
I hear you, but I think it's your computer mic, so maybe we'll have to sort that out for the post game. Folks, that we will be talking. I think we'll be doing some Patrick Bet David.
Oh, there you go. Is this better?
Yep.
No, folks, patreon.com/leftreckoning.
I have unearthed something that even Matt Leck hasn't seen yet. That is so good that I'm just going to leave it at that. You're going to want to come over patreon.com/leftreckoning. We got some fun clips. We'll be taking questions from the audience, hang out a little bit. It's been a little while since we've done one. So post game, patreon.com/leftreckoning, come and hang out with us. I know that's a vague teaser, but you got to come into this thing fresh. All right. patreon.com/leftreckoning. We'll be over there about 10, 15 minutes. Come see us.
See you, folks.